Those are some big words. But what Carson means by that is Jesus is speaking in a way that causes people to say, what did he say? Did he really say that? And what does he mean by that? It was a way of capturing their attention, of in some sense shocking them into taking note. Now I sometimes do that with things, with objects. There was the one occasion when I threw a cow paddy, a cow poo, into the middle of the congregation just to catch their attention, just so they would recognize, as Paul was saying, that our attempts at self-righteousness are like poo, are like dung. And I know that to this day, people who were part of that service are still saying, do you remember that sermon when Ian threw that car paddy into the midst of us? Do you remember? What was that about again? It's a way of capturing people's imagination. And Jesus does that not with objects, but with the style of his preaching, with this, what we're calling antithetical type style of communicating. And through that, I think you need to recognize that he wants to shock his audience, but he doesn't intend to be taken literally. You've got to hear me on this. He does not intend to be taken literally. And I can say that without a shadow of a doubt in view of the way that he's speaking, even lower down. So if you look to verse 29, Jesus is talking about cutting away different members of our bodies if they cause us to sin. He talks about, you know, if your hand causes you to sin, cut it off. Better to enter heaven with one hand than to enter hell with two. And in verse 29, he speaks about if your eye causes you to sin, pluck it out, gouge it out. Better to enter heaven with one eye than to enter hell with two. Now, I want you to recognize he's not meaning this literally. Let me explain why. First of all, how does one eye sin and not the other? Does he imagine that people are walking around with a patch over one eye as they scan through a glossy magazine? And besides, there's no disadvantage in going to heaven minus a member. Because as soon as you get there, boop, it's going to be back again because we're going to be remade new. So he's not meaning it to be taken literally. I hope you recognize that. I hope you recognize that he's saying these things for effect, to shock people. And at the same time, though, the hearers, the folk that he's speaking to, understand clearly what he's getting at. They know what the deeper meaning is. That Jesus is saying, folk, you need to take seriously the issue of sin in your life. You need to deal with it in a decisive manner. Even if it means tearing up those glossy magazines underneath your mattress, tear them up. If it means avoiding certain sites on your computer because you struggle with pornography, avoid those sites. If it means actually sharing, bringing another friend into your problem and asking him to keep a watch on you, do that. Sin needs decisive action. That's the meaning of what he's actually conveying through these words. And so when we turn in a moment to our passage for this morning, you need to bear in mind the style of preaching, the style of communication that Jesus has adopted. You need to be listening for the underlying message and not get derailed by the literal meaning of Jesus' words. That's something you've got to bear in mind, just by way of explanation. Then secondly, the second thing we need to bear in mind is that we need to bear in mind the context in which these words occur. And you can see the context from verse 20, the previous verse. Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. It's number 3 on the sheet there, please, Conti. There he is. Unless your righteousness surpasses that of the Pharisees and the teachers of the law, you will certainly not enter the kingdom of heaven. The mistake that the Pharisees made was to assume that the external is what's important. They focused on the outward performance, outward observance of the law. As long as you washed your hands in a certain way, as long as you avoided certain foods, as long as you did no work on the Sabbath, and so on, this made you acceptable to God. The outward observance was all important. Righteousness was all about outward performance, outward observance. But as Jesus explains in verse 20, the righteousness of God is something far more than that. The righteousness that meets the standard that God requires of us, that God has set for us, is something that goes way beyond the righteousness of the Pharisees. Jesus doesn't set the law aside. What he does is he extends its application. He gives it wings, as it were, so that we understand what it's really all about. And we can see this as we now turn to our passage. We can see how this works in terms of his handling of what is in fact the sixth commandment. Ten commandments, the sixth commandment, you shall not murder. Have a look at verse 21 with me to see how this works itself out. You've heard it said to the people long ago, you shall not murder, and anyone who murders will be subject to judgment. When Jesus says, you have heard it said, but I say to you, he's not changing the law. He's not setting aside Old Testament law. He's not setting aside the sixth commandment. He doesn't say the Old Testament says, but I say. No, it's what they heard about this Old Testament commandment. It's what they had been taught. And he takes issue with what they had been taught. It's the teaching that they had received that he now wants to correct. You have heard it said, but I say to you. Your religious leaders taught you that the law is to be read in this way, but I want you to understand that it's really to be read in this way. He's correcting their understanding. The Jews had assumed, as we've already seen wrongly, that this commandment referred only to the outward act of killing somebody, of taking someone's life, of intentionally doing it. As far as they were concerned, it was all about the very act of spilling blood, of killing somebody. And as long as you had not done that, as long as you had not spilled blood, well, then you could notch up this commandment as another one that you had kept fully, because you hadn't actually murdered anybody. This was the righteousness of the Pharisees. So the command not to murder, explains people, is not merely about the outward. No, it's about something far deeper than that. It's also about spiteful attitudes that we keep within our hearts, that lurk in the dark recesses of our minds. That desire for revenge, for example. Those attitudes that seek to wound and injure another person who has in some way offended you. That's also included within this particular commandment. You've heard it said, you shall not murder, but I tell you that anyone who is angry with their brother or sister will be subject to judgment. It's more than just the outward act. And there are, of course, different types of anger. We understand that. There is the sort of anger that is spiteful, that is vengeful, that is mean-spirited. But there's also a different type of anger, the anger that we would call a righteous anger, an anger that is indignant at the suffering of the poor or the manipulation of the weak, the injustice done to others. There's that sort of righteousness. And in what follows, in our passage, we have a clear indication of the sort of anger that Jesus has in mind when he speaks about anger being tantamount to murder. This sort of anger expresses itself in contempt for other people, for another person. It's raka. It's the word suggests the idea of it's empty. You're empty. You're brainless. You're worthless. You don't deserve any attention because you are just not even don't even exist as far as I'm concerned. Raka. It's an anger that expresses itself with the word moro. Fool, from which we get our word moron. You're not worth the oxygen that you're using up. You're an idiot. You're an imbecile. You're just stupid. It's that sort of anger that Jesus is speaking of in this particular occasion, in these words. You feel this anger towards somebody else, presumably because they have crossed you in some way, or they've dared to challenge your thoughts or your ideas, or they've spoken to you in a way that you consider inappropriate, and you feel anger towards them. There were, of course, occasions when Jesus himself expressed anger. But you'll notice it was never, ever because of personal offense. It was always in defense of others. It was always because he was indignant at the way other people had been either misled or dealt with in an unjust sort of way. On one occasion, he was talking to a man who had come to him to be healed from his leprosy, and we're told Jesus was angry. Not because the man was asking him to heal him, but he was angry because of the ravages of the leprosy. On another occasion, Jesus is angry with the Pharisees, who instead of making it easier for people to come to God, had loaded them up with so much other stuff that it was impossible for them to continue. And then on another occasion, Jesus was angry because the religious leaders in the temple had imported the marketplace into the very place which was reserved for worship. And here were all these cattle and these sheep and these birds and so on, making it difficult for people to now worship. And he was indignant. He was angry with that. It was a righteous anger. But it was never in response to personal offense. You remember when Jesus was hanging on the cross and people were passing by, and as they stopped, they had they amused themselves by hurling insults at him and mocking him and jeering at him and insulting him. Do you remember his response? Do you remember what he said on that occasion? "Father, smash them into smithereens, crush them into 1,000 pieces. May they die a miserable and a slow death." No, it's not what he said. We hear those gracious words, "Father, forgive them, for they don't know what they're doing." A righteous anger. Now, before we start justifying our own anger as righteous anger, just remember that that's very seldom the case for us. More often than not, we've been personally offended in some way, and we can try and justify it as righteous anger, but often, more often than not, it's not. Now we could get sidetracked in trying to sort of like graduate the different types of punishment. You know, if you do this, you suffer one type of punishment, and if you do that, you then suffer the fires of hell and so on, because there are these different punishments that are referred to in the passage, and I want to say that's to miss the point altogether. What's the message is this? The message is that attitudes, spiteful, bitter attitudes, are like murder. And murder is offensive to God. And so hateful thoughts and bitterness are things that he finds displeasure in. He takes displeasure in those things. And if they are not dealt with in some way, they will land us in deep trouble when we stand before him on that occasion, when we are all judged before him. The fires of hell, by the way, which referred to in our passage, the fires of hell is a reference in the Greek to this valley, the Valley of Hinnom, which was just outside the city gates. And all the rubbish of the city would be thrown into this valley, the Valley of Hinnom, and then it would be burned. And there was this continual stench and the smoke and the fire rising from the Valley of Hinnom. And it was a useful picture to portray something of the awfulness of what happens when we are excluded from God's heaven, when we go to hell. It's a picture. The fires of hell. And what Jesus is in effect saying is, we're talking about serious stuff here. So, what about you? What about you? Do you sometimes nurture bitterness against another person in your heart? Do you? Have you ever played over in your mind a scenario where you get even with somebody who's done something to you that you consider horrible And you're going to get back and you go through in your mind what you're going to do when you next meet them. Have you ever done that? Do you ever wish that somebody was dead? That a truck would come out and run them over because they have been so awful to you? A friend of mine, true story, his marriage was not in a good shape, and you can understand why, because he unraveled this crumpled piece of paper on the floor, and in it his wife had written, she was actually praying to God that he would take her husband, that he would have him killed in some way. Imagine that. Imagine opening up a crumpled piece of paper and finding that your wife hated you so much, she wanted you dead. And the point I think that Jesus is making in this passage is that when we allow anger and bitterness to simmer in our hearts, there's not much that separates us from the murderer. Not much. Not much that actually separates us from the person who pulls out a knife and actually stabs us. There's little differentiation between the two. And the punishment that is reserved for the murderer is reserved also for those of us who are guilty of breaking this sixth commandment in this way. So, how many murderers do we have in our congregation this morning? I think all of us, if we're honest, all of us are guilty. Every one of us has failed to keep this commandment at one time or another. Now what Jesus does now is he turns in his sermon to two practical ways in which this can work itself out in everyday life. And the first concerns anger as an impediment to authentic worship. You can see that in verse 23 to 24. Therefore, if you are offering your gift at the altar and there remember that your brother or sister has something against you, leave your gift there in front of the altar. First go and be reconciled to them. Then come and offer your gift. The parallel in our case would be you're about to take communion and you suddenly realize there's somebody that you have offended and they're holding a grudge and you say to yourself, I better not take communion. I better go and be reconciled to this person first of all. And then, only then, come and take communion. That would be, I think, a parallel to what Jesus is talking about here. There is something else here, though, that I had never noticed, and it might be new for you too. Whenever I've taken communion, I've checked my own heart. I've asked myself the question, is there anyone that I'm feeling angry towards, anyone that I'm feeling bitter about? And when I've come up with the answer, well, no, I can't, on some occasions, I can't really think of anyone who I'm angry towards. And then I've taken communion thinking, well, that's how this thing works. But I'd never realized it's the other way around. Do you see that in the passage? Jesus is saying, if you realize that somebody else has a problem against you, that you have offended them and they're still holding a grudge, the responsibility, the obligation is upon you to be reconciled. You may have offended Jane in some way and you've moved on from there. You've forgotten about it and you're going ahead and Jane still holds a grudge. She's still hurting. She's still in pain. And what Jesus is saying is, go be reconciled to Jane first. And then come and take communion. Now, you might not realize this, but we have abandoned communion this morning. I just thought it would be appropriate to give everyone, including myself, a chance to be reconciled before we come and take communion next week. Hopefully, this will have spoken at least to some of us about something that is pressing that we need to do soon. Now, to press home his point, what Jesus does is he talks about the fact that he makes the point that it's important that we treat this with an urgency, that it's serious and it needs to be attended to quickly. And he uses the analogy from their legal framework at the time, their legal system, as something that was in operation at the time, whereby if you had a dispute with somebody about finances, there's some financial sort of issue that there's disagreement over, and he takes you to court, and then If you get found guilty, you get thrown into what they call debtor's prison. And in debtor's prison, you would stay there until you'd paid off your full debt. The problem was, in debtor's prison, you couldn't work. So you couldn't earn money. So how could you pay it off? And the answer is, well, you couldn't. You just languish in prison with this huge debt over you. And what Jesus is saying is, there was an opportunity there. As the two of you were walking down to the courthouse, there was an opportunity. Very brief, not much time. You should have taken advantage of it. You should have used that opportunity. You should have acted quickly. Otherwise, you bear this incredible consequence. Do it now. Don't delay. Sort out your differences quickly, is what Jesus is saying. Harboring bitterness in your heart and failing to sort out things with another person can have, and you realize this, I know, serious consequences. Because it somehow escalates. It grows. It builds. Suddenly other people are being called into the dispute, and suddenly other people are taking sides, and the next minute there's slander occurring, and people are being accused of all sorts of things, and the next minute the church the unity of the church is disrupted, and everybody's pulling in different directions, and what was a molehill has now become a mountain. Because you didn't deal with it early on when you had the opportunity. That, I think, is something of what Jesus is saying here. So how should we respond to the teaching of Jesus on anger and murder? Just want to take you through five very brief comments. We should be humbled by it. Hopefully there's not one of us who'll go away saying, aren't I a wonderful person? Because I've kept all of God's commands. Hopefully, at least in this regard, you'll be saying to yourself, I know that I've failed here on a number of occasions and I am guilty. I may have not committed outward murder, but I have murdered people. I have assassinated people's character. And that should, secondly, drive us back to Jesus. That should drive us back to seeking Jesus, forgiveness from Jesus. I haven't used this illustration before. I'm not even sure if it's appropriate, but I'm going to use it anyway because I think it speaks to us. Have you ever gone to the loo and found that there's, too late, in fact, that there's no toilet paper? Have you ever done that? And it's sort of like messy, you know, and you sort of, what can I do? There's only one thing you can do. Linda, can you bring me some loo paper, please? And that's something I think of what we're encouraged to do in the scriptures. Call out to Jesus. Yes, we may have messed up our lives, but there is hope if we only trust in Jesus, who's paid the price, who's gone to the cross for us, who's died in our place, so that we can be forgiven, so that the mess can be cleaned up. It should drive us back to Jesus. And then thirdly, we should take great care over our heart. Don't allow bitterness and resentment to linger there. Confess it. Expunge it. Give no opportunity, says Paul, for the devil to gain a foothold. Don't allow it to take root. And then fourthly, take care of the way you speak about other people. I know we can sort of write it off as, oh, not important, but slander is slander, and it's all part of this whole sort of thing we've been talking about this morning. Every time we speak ill of someone, every time we injure them in some way, do them harm by our words, we are making ourselves guilty of murder all over again. And then lastly, call upon the Holy Spirit. We can't sort this out ourselves. We can't do this on our own. We need His help. We need His strength so that we can be pure, as Jesus said, perfect like our Father in heaven is perfect. The only way we're going to approximate to that is through the help, relying upon the Holy Spirit. Amen. Why don't we just spend a moment in quiet reflection and meditation on these words from Matthew 5. come, let's throw ourselves upon the mercy of God.